KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Vivek Murthy became America's youngest ever Surgeon General at age 37 after President Obama appointed him in 2014. His view of gun violence as a public health issue made him a controversial appointment from the start. But as Surgeon General, Murthy focused his time on fighting opioid and alcohol addiction. After President Trump dismissed him in April, Murthy has spoken out against efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and more recently has highlighted the health effects of loneliness and emotional stress. He joins us on Forum after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Dr. Vivek Murthy's tenure as U.S. Surgeon General was relatively brief after he was appointed by President Obama in 2014. His nomination stalled in the Senate for more than a year after Murthy drew the ire of the National Rifle Association for calling gun violence a public health issue. And he was removed by President Trump shortly after Trump took office, widely believed for the same reason, making Murthy the rare Surgeon General unable to complete a four-year term. Murthy is a vice admiral and research scientist with expertise on addiction and the opioid crisis. He's also raised concerns about the nation's emotional well-being and the effects of loneliness. Vivek Murthy, welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for being here. You know, when you departed departed your role as U.S. Surgeon General, you wrote a note where you talked about sort of four key things that you learned while you were there. And I was wondering if you could share what those were.
Sure. Well, it's interesting you mentioned those because I was just reading those last night.
Really?
Actually. Yes. I wrote a message to the country and on the day that I was terminated by President Trump. And in that note, I tried to capture some of the key lessons that I had learned from the American people. You know, I really looked at this job as Surgeon General as really one of the great privileges of my life. My parents were immigrants. They came, like so many other immigrants, to this country with hopes that their kids would have a better future. But those were hopes, and they never knew how life would really turn out for us. And I'm just so incredibly grateful to our country that I've had an opportunity not only to get a great education, to meet so many wonderful friends and mentors, but to have had the chance to serve our country in the role as Surgeon General. When I was in office, I spent a lot of time on the road talking to communities. And the lessons that I shared in that final message to the country were based on the conversations I had around the country. They were lessons that people had taught me. The role of Surgeon General is often thought of as being an educator, but I found that it was I who was the one who was educated during my time in office. Some of the things that people taught me were that, number one, that kindness is a virtue. It is not a source of weakness. It is a value that we have to think about and practice in our day-to-day lives. And if we can inculcate our kids with a sense of kindness, with a notion that kindness must be the bedrock of how we interact with ourselves and the world, then I believe we can truly make them strong and we can make our communities strong. But the other point that I made in that letter was that we need to find new ways to talk to each other as a country. We have lost the ability to dialogue. And to truly reconnect with each other again, I believe that we need to start listening more and understanding each other. We need to pause before we judge. We need to also think about the fact that people's intentions are often good, and we need to assume good before condemning people. If we can do those things, then I believe we can rebuild our connections with each other. And doing so is going to be essential if we want to come together and take on the big problems that we face.
When you talk about connecting with others, it reminds me of the work that you've done specifically. I mean, you've talked about emotional well-being, but specifically around loneliness. Can you talk about how that connects to loneliness as you've described a growing health epidemic?
Yeah, during my time in office, I heard a lot about loneliness from the people I met in communities across the country. But the truth is, I had been hearing about loneliness even before I was in office. During my time as a doctor practicing medicine in Boston, Massachusetts, the most common illness that I saw was not heart disease or diabetes or cancer. It was, in fact, loneliness. Loneliness that was often grounded in a lack of self-worth and a lack of meaning. There are far too many people in our country who feel lonely. And this is ironic because we are living in the most technologically connected time in the history of civilization. Yet loneliness rates among adults have been increasing over the last few decades. The reason that I've been writing about and speaking about loneliness more is because science tells us more about the health impact of loneliness. It tells us, in fact, that loneliness is associated with shorter lifespans. And in fact, the increase in mortality from loneliness is comparable to the impact of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It's even greater than the impact of obesity. We know now that loneliness is associated with an increase in heart disease, in depression, and anxiety, and dementia. And if you really want to understand why...
Yes, I do.
Then you have to just understand a little bit about our evolution as people and about biology. You know, we evolved to be social creatures. Thousands of years ago, your ability to have a stable food supply and to be protected from predators was enhanced if you had other people who were working together with you, who you could trust. And over thousands of years, that social connection and need for it became baked into our nervous system. So if you are experiencing inadequate social connections, and we can talk about what that means, then that actually creates a physiological stress state in the body. And chronic stress, stress that is in place for a long period of time, is known to have profoundly negative consequences for the body. It can increase cortisol levels, increase inflammation, which can damage blood vessels and tissues, and increase rates of arthritis, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and a host of other illnesses.
So what does constitute inadequate social connection?
Well, that's a great question, and it is not, in fact, an objective definition. So it turns out loneliness is a subjective state. You could have 1,000 friends all around you and still feel lonely, or you could have only one friend and feel not lonely at all. This is especially relevant today because our cities are filled with people who have thousands of friends on Facebook and thousands of connections on LinkedIn and thousands of followers on Twitter. They live in densely populated condo buildings. They're surrounded by people all day at work, but they feel profoundly alone. So simply being around people is not enough to ensure that you are not lonely. The quality of your connection with people is what matters.
And are you saying that people think that technology, or they're actually substituting connections on technology as interactions with people?
That is one danger of technology, that online relationships can be taken as or assumed to be equivalent to offline relationships. But we know that they're not the same. I say this as somebody who's a strong believer in technology. I'm an avid user of technology. I spent 7 years building a technology company. I believe in the power of technology to advance medicine and society. But we have to understand that technology at the end of the day is a tool. And it can be used for good or it could be used for bad. It could have adverse consequences that we need to be aware of. And I think one thing that we have seen is that social media in particular can have a range of benefits. It can bring interesting ideas to us, connect us with old friends from college or high school. But we also have to recognize that it is not a substitute for in-person connection.
Does the fact that people tend to be shy about admitting they're lonely have anything to do with the manifestation or chronic condition of loneliness?
Well, I think there is a stigma around loneliness. And I say this not just because I have spoken to people who don't feel comfortable often telling others that they're lonely. But I say this from a very personal level as well, as somebody who was very lonely as a child. I grew up with parents who loved me dearly and a sister who cared for me like a second mother. I never doubted their love or their compassion or concern for me. But I was a very shy kid who had trouble making friends outside of my family. And I did feel lonely a lot, but I didn't feel comfortable telling anyone that because I felt ashamed. I felt that if I was lonely, that meant that I was not worthy of being loved. And so to this day, I have not told my parents about the fact that I was lonely as a child. I didn't want them to feel like they did something wrong, or I didn't want them to worry about me. But there are people all across our country and truly all across the world who feel ashamed that they are lonely and feel that it's a poor reflection of who they are.
We're talking with former U.S. Surgeon General under President Obama, Vivek Murthy. As you talk about the stigma associated with loneliness, it reminds me of things that you've said about the stigma associated with addiction. This seems to be a big focus for you in terms of one of the key ways to try to address the opioid epidemic. Can you draw that connection for us?
Sure. There's an unfortunate connection here. You know, loneliness, mental illness, substance use and addiction, they all very sadly are saddled with this unfortunate stigma. You know, I tell people when it comes to loneliness that if you are feeling lonely, you are not the only one. And if you are not feeling lonely, chances are that there is someone around you who is, and you can play a role in helping them. The same is true with substance use and addiction. I found when I was in medicine, practicing and caring for patients, that addiction was far more common than I thought it would be. I thought as an internal medicine doctor that I was going to spend most of my time taking care of people who had infections and diabetes and heart disease. What I found in reality was that many patients I was caring for were struggling with substance use disorders, and that had a profound impact on their ability to care for their other illnesses as well. But the challenge we have right now in America is that we have nearly 21 million people who are struggling with a substance use disorder, but only 1 in 10 of them is actually getting treatment. And this is a point that we made when I published the first Surgeon General's report on substance use and addiction in November of 2016. But I asked people also to imagine what it would be like if only 1 in 10 people with diabetes was getting treatment, or if only 1 in 10 people who had heart disease could get treatment, or if only 1 in 10 people with cancer could get treatment. Would we tolerate that as a society? The answer is absolutely not. We would say that's unjust. And that is the case with substance use disorders as well. So part of the challenge here in addressing substance use disorders is that there is this unfortunate stigma around addiction. People think of addiction as a purely a disease of choice. They think about it as a lifestyle instead of the chronic disease that it is. But when we understand the science behind addiction, we understand that this is a chronic illness of the brain that affects our brain circuits in critical parts of the brain that in fact control decision-making and judgment. So for anyone who has tried to, for example, go on a new diet plan or go on a new workout regimen, and I know many of us have, I certainly have, we know that it's pretty easy to fall off the wagon and to fail at our diet or exercise plan, and that has happened to me as well. But I want you to imagine for a moment how much harder it would be if the very part of your brain that controlled judgment and decision-making was in fact compromised. How much harder would it be to make a commitment to stay on your diet plan and stick to it? Well, that is what people with addiction are struggling with on a day-to-day basis. If we see this as a disease, then we can treat it as such. Instead of putting people in jail who are struggling with addiction, we can actually get them to treatment. And that ultimately will make all of us healthier and stronger.
Isn't part of the reason, though, that people are not getting treatment also the fact that there seems to be a shortage of doctors in addiction-related medicine or addiction medicine?
Well, that's absolutely true. When it comes to addressing addiction, there's no one single thing that we have to do. We have to address the unfortunate stigma around it. We have to increase the number of healthcare professionals who know how to screen for and treat substance use disorders. We need to change the way our healthcare system is structured to better integrate substance use treatment with traditional medical care. But if you ask the question, why aren't medical students going into the field of addiction medicine? It has in part to do with the fact that there has been a stigma even within medicine around addiction. When I was actually a third-year medical student, I remember my very first rotation was in the emergency room. And I remember an emergency room attending saying to me when a patient came in with addiction, I remember him saying, gosh, you know, these people keep coming in and they keep taking up our beds and taking our time away from people who really need help. And I wish they would just get their act together because they're a drain on the healthcare system. And the message to me as a young medical student was that these people who are struggling with addiction don't deserve the same time and care that other people do. We also traditionally have not reimbursed people who work in addiction medicine very well. They have had to do their job without a lot of the structural supports that are actually necessary. And so it has not always been an attractive profession for young medical students and residents to go into. But what I tell medical students when I talk to them, and residents and full-fledged doctors, is I tell them that screening for and treating substance use disorders needs to be part of the basic skill set that every doctor has. You know, if you're a dermatologist or a pathologist or a cardiologist, you were taught how to measure blood pressure and adjust blood pressure medicines. You were taught how to interpret blood sugar levels in a patient who has diabetes and adjust their medicines accordingly. I believe we've come to the point where we need to make the screening and treatment of substance use disorders part of that basic skill set that every doctor has.
So you've mentioned two key things in terms of trying to address the opioid crisis. President Trump has said for some time now that he will declare a national emergency, free up resources. Do you think that that will help? Do you have any sense of the specifics of his plan around trying to address this? And if so, could you shed some light on what that is and if you think it will be effective? Because the news this week has been that he's actually had a tough time, for example, getting a drug czar, which is someone who would play a key role in trying to address this as well. We heard about Tom Marino, the Republican from Pennsylvania, who withdrew his name from consideration for this role. So it just feels like it's very hard for the government to wrap their arms around this issue.
Yeah, well, I feel very proud of the fact that for a number of years now, addressing addiction has in fact been a bipartisan issue. And during the Obama administration, Republicans and Democrats worked together to get more funding for treatment and for naloxone and for changing prescribing practices. The President Trump's Opioid Commission has actually made some good recommendations for what we should do to address the opioid crisis. They are reiterations in many cases of recommendations that have been made before, but they are good recommendations nonetheless. One of those was to declare a national emergency around opioids. Now, I think whether or not that's useful depends on several factors. Number one, is there real resources attached to it? Or is there actual funds that can go towards expanding prevention and treatment? Number two, how are those funds actually going to be used? If they're going to take 2, 3, 4 years to actually roll out through complex grant processes, and if they won't get to the communities that actually need them for a while, then they're going to be of less utility. And the third question is the declaration of an emergency more rhetoric, or is it going to bring real help to people? You know, I think it is important to call out things for what they are. This isn't a national crisis, the opioid epidemic. It requires everyone to do what they can, when they can, for as long as they can to address it. But we've got to go beyond words. We have to attach real resources. We have to make sure those resources can be used and, you know, efficiently. But we also have to track our progress. And unfortunately, sometimes the history of government initiatives is that directives are put out without clear mechanisms for achieving them or goals and timelines and targets. I haven't yet seen those kind of targets from the Trump administration. My hope is that they will get serious about nailing down exactly how they're going to get resources to communities quickly and that they're going to set concrete metrics to which they can hold themselves and the country accountable. But until that happens, you know, I'm worried that we may be looking at more rhetoric than actual help.
And part of that, you've also raised concerns about the president's posture towards the Affordable Care Act and whether that will reduce the access needed for people to get help who are suffering from opioid addiction.
Yeah, we have to realize that addiction doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's very much tied to the other aspects of people's health. So people struggling with substance use disorders very often have chronic pain disorders that they're also seeking to manage. They may have heart disease and diabetes that has to be managed. And if you pass a health reform proposal that actually reduces the number of people who have healthcare coverage, you make it harder for them not only to get treatment for their substance use disorder, but to get treatment for the other health conditions that they're struggling with that can in fact affect their substance use disorder. So we have to remember people are whole people. They are not just slivers of an illness. And providing them with comprehensive care has to be at the heart of any health reform proposal. That has been my concern with some of the plans that the president had put forward earlier, which would have the impact of reducing either the number of people who are covered or the quality of coverage. In the Affordable Care Act, one of the key provisions that was put in place was the essential health benefits, and substance use and addiction services were included in those, meaning that any insurance plan had to cover substance use and addiction services as part of an essential health benefits package.
Yes.
Some of the health plans that we've seen recently proposed have threatened to roll that back and to water down the essential health benefits. And one of the consequences would be that it would be harder for some people to actually get the care that they needed as they were struggling with substance use disorder. So we have to see that there are consequences to things like reducing coverage that go well beyond what you read about sometimes in the paper. And that is why I have always said that if we want to improve substance use in America, if we want to reduce addiction, we have to recognize a comprehensive healthcare coverage is an important piece of that solution.
Well, I'd like to invite our listeners to talk with you. If you'd like to ask former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy a question about the opioid crisis, mental health, the role of stigma and addiction in our emotional well-being, the phone lines are open to you. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, post your comments on Facebook, on Twitter, or on our website, kqed.org/forum. One of the things, as Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, you were in charge of responding to natural disaster responses in terms of the public health effects that they have. What, given the fact that we just had these significant wildfires here in the region, what are some of the effects of that that you want to highlight for us and that we should, you know, try to address as early as possible?
Well, first of all, I have just been heartbroken to see how the fires in the Bay Area have been impacting people's lives and their homes. My in-laws, my mother-in-law, my sister-in-law, my father-in-law, all live in the Bay Area. In fact, they live in San Rafael, not too far from where many of the fires were raging. And I was very worried about them during that time, and as was my wife. But I know that there were thousands of families that have been struggling, if not with the loss of life and property, with the threat of that loss. And the truth is that that takes an enormous toll on people's mental health. With these natural disasters in general, whether it's a hurricane, a fire, or a tornado, there are short-term consequences, and then there are medium to long-term consequences. And the mental health effects in terms of post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and depression can sometimes last for months, and they can easily be missed. You know, I grew up actually during one of our nation's major natural disasters. I was living in Miami at the time that Hurricane Andrew struck in 1992. And I remember being huddled together in the house with my mother and my father and my sister as the nearly 200-mile-per-hour winds battered our home and homes around us. I remember not having, you know, electricity for 3 weeks or phones for 6 weeks. And this was all pre-cell phone age. We felt very disconnected, unsure of what was going to happen. And that was stressful. And for months afterwards, as we tried to rebuild in our community, many of our neighbors and others were also experiencing a great amount of stress and anxiety. So people, though, forget about that piece of it. And my concern about the Bay Area is that these fires, in addition to the immediate consequences for people's health and their homes, may also have more lasting impacts on anxiety and stress levels. And that's why, as healthcare providers in the area, we have to be mindful of screening for that and asking about how people are doing in terms of managing anxiety and stress. But also, as community members, we can all be mindful of the fact that even when the immediate threat of the fire is over, that there may be more lasting consequences that we have to be mindful of, that we have to talk to people about. And simply opening a conversation with people to ask them how they're feeling about the fires can give them a chance to talk about their stress and hopefully to mitigate some of it.
Vivek Murthy, former U.S. Surgeon General, appointed under President Obama. He has talked a lot since his time as Surgeon General about the role of addiction, mental health issues, the opioid crisis, and about gun violence, which we'll get into after the break. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. He's a vice admiral and research scientist with expertise on addiction and the opioid crisis, who's also raised concerns about the nation's emotional well-being and the effects of loneliness. He's a graduate of Harvard and Yale medical schools and has been a professor, teacher at Harvard as well. And we have comments coming in from our listeners, Vivek Murthy. David asked, related to opiates, why don't we tax opiate sales to fund drug treatment programs?
Well, I think it's an interesting question, and what it gets at is the truth that we don't have enough funding for drug treatment programs right now. And this actually was an important point that has come up in the last few months as people have been discussing health reform proposals in Washington, D.C. and thinking about how to fund addiction treatment. The bottom line is that it's not $1 billion or $2 billion, you know, that's going to fill that pot. But we actually need quite a lot more if we truly want to close the treatment gap. One of the points that we had made earlier in our conversation was the fact that only 1 in 10 people with addiction are actually getting treatment. That's going to mean we need a lot more centers to treat addiction. We need a lot more doctors and nurses trained in how to handle addiction. We need a lot more public education efforts so people know that they need to come forward and get help. There have been some members of Congress who have proposed this idea of taxing opioid sales. In fact, I think Senator Manchin was one of them. He had a one cent per milligram tax, I think, that he wanted to levy. What I think of is the fact that when proposals like this are raised, is that we actually do need to get pharmaceutical companies more engaged in solutions. Part of what drove this problem was a confluence of factors. There was a role that doctors played in this. There was a role that policymakers played in terms of not having enough treatment. And there's a role that pharmaceutical companies played as well in terms of pushing opioid medications, often without giving enough attention to the adverse consequences of opioids. And now I think all these sectors need to step up and be a part of the solution. So I would like to see pharmaceutical companies step up and play more of a role in public education, in funding treatment, and very importantly, in funding prevention programs, which is an area where we have rarely ever put sufficient focus.
Well, Robert asks, Dr. Murthy, a most thoughtful and open-minded public servant, was rejected by Republicans for having the position that our gun epidemic should be looked at as a public health issue. Dr. Murthy, how is it possible to have an open discussion with such rigid extremists? Could you first talk about why it was so important for you to, and it's not a new idea that gun violence is a public health issue, but why it was so important for you to champion that?
Well, for me personally, it was important to say because I have seen the effects of gun violence up close. I've cared for so many patients who have not only been acutely affected by gun violence in terms of the threat to their own lives, but they've been living with the consequences of gun violence for years in terms of post-traumatic stress disorder, in terms of spinal cord injury and paralysis. So this was very much on my mind because I have seen it far too often in my practice of medicine. But what particularly prompted me to speak out about gun violence when I did was the horrific, tragic Newtown shooting that we had, where so many young children were killed senselessly. And, you know, I do believe that gun violence is a public health issue. Whenever you have large numbers of people who are dying for preventable reasons, that constitutes a public health issue, and gun violence is, in fact, one of those. Now, I recognize that it can seem like our debate is entrenched on polarized sides. I can recognize that many people have lost hope that anything will come out of Washington, D.C. that will actually address our gun violence epidemic. But there are a few reasons why I remain hopeful. One is because I don't think that the country is as polarized as it seems, if you read the news or if you look at our politicians. I think there are far more people support reasonable measures, as evidenced by the fact that the vast majority of the country, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, support background checks, even though that simple measure was not able to be passed by Congress. But the second thing I think that's important to keep in mind is that addressing gun violence requires a number of measures. It's not only about passing sensible gun laws and enforcing them, as important as that is. But it's also about focusing on gun safety so that parents know that it's not safe to leave loaded and unlocked weapons at home when their children are home alone. It also is important for us to focus on expanding our mental health screening and resources for treatment, which is one of the reasons why I'm actually glad to be in the Bay Area visiting with my friend David Mineta, who runs Momentum for Mental Health, an organization which is providing great mental health care to folks in the Bay Area.
And you'll be speaking this evening at their event.
And that's right. That's absolutely right.
In San
right.
Jose.
That's mm-hmm. right. But the last piece around gun violence is that we have to ask ourselves a deeper and tougher question, which is, what are the origins of violence to begin with? Why do people choose to act out and physically harm someone else? That's a tough question. It's a complicated question. Sometimes we reach reflexively for serious mental illness as the reason why that happens. But I think that's a mistake because it risks stigmatizing people with mental illness. It turns out that people with mental illness are far more likely to be the victims of violence than the perpetrators of violence. But I do think that the answer is grounded in the topic of emotional well-being. We do have a high degree of chronic stress in our country that has led to anxiety and to depression, and for many people, a sense of hopelessness. But when I look at programs that have invested in improving emotional well-being, in schools in particular, they have had a profound impact on reducing the amount of violence in schools. And I think that there's a larger lesson there, that we need to recognize the impact of emotional well-being on violence and other aspects of our health. We have to invest in science to understand how best to promote and enhance emotional well-being. And we need to start implementing and scaling programs that work all across our country. To me, this is the ultimate form of prevention. It's investing in emotional well-being will not only help us reduce violence, it will help us address our opioid epidemic. It will help us address the toxic political dialogue that we have in our country. Because the truth is, when people are stressed, when they're anxious, they can't talk to each other well. And that's what we're seeing right now in America.
And examples of ways to address emotional well-being that you've seen that are successful?
Well, there are two big approaches we have to take to addressing emotional well-being. One is to look at what is creating stress in people's lives. And there are many structural factors, for including poverty and chronic illness and discrimination. But we also have to look at the tools that we can equip people with to enhance their own resilience. These tools, include social connection, which is a powerful way to reduce stress. But again, many people are feeling lonely today. They also include simple things like exercise. Physical exercise is actually a powerful acute antidepressant. It elevates your mood. I frankly wish I had known that 20, 30 years ago when I was dealing with a lot of stress in my training. But there are others as well. Contemplative practices like meditation are very powerful in enhancing emotional well-being. Sleep, we're realizing more and more through science, is an incredibly important piece of emotional well-being. So my belief is that we have to both work on addressing the drivers of stress while simultaneously equipping people with the skills and tools they need to deal with stress. And the programs that I have seen in schools in particular have been doing just this, like the Becoming a Man program in Chicago, which has brought at-risk young men together to help build connections with other young men and receive mentorship once a week about conflict resolution. In just 32 weeks, that program, compared to when experimental and control groups were compared, was able to reduce violent arrests by 44% among at-risk young men. There was no new medications involved. There were no complex medical technology that was involved. This was about old school skills and wisdom of building connections with people, enabling them to talk to each other, helping them find healthy ways of dealing with stress.
In listening to you talk, I vacillate between feeling enlightened and completely overwhelmed in terms of addressing the health issues of our nation.
Well, part of what is overwhelming or can be overwhelming about the problems we're talking about, whether it's addiction or violence, is that these are complicated problems that don't have a single solution. But what gives me hope is that there is, I believe, a thread of simplicity here as well, which is that when we focus on enhancing emotional well-being for kids in particular, we find that it can actually affect many problems that we are dealing with. So I'll give you one example. There's a program called the Good Behavior Games program, which is often implemented in elementary schools and middle schools. And this is a program that enables kids to come together in small groups and clarify and identify what their values and norms are and help each other to figure out how to live according to those norms. And part of that involves trying to figure out how you deal with life and with other people when things don't go according to your expectations. So if somebody lashes out at you verbally or physically, how do you handle that? If you are disappointed because your expectations weren't met, how do you deal with the stress that comes from that? This program, when people look at it longitudinally, has been found to have profound impacts on whether or not kids engage in unhealthy behavior. So out of 1,000 kids who may participate in this, you would have 89 fewer children who develop a substance use disorder. You have many fewer kids who develop alcohol use disorders, far fewer teen pregnancies, higher graduation rates, better grades and test scores. My point is that we can think about each problem in a silo and try to figure out all the different solutions and policies that we need to enact. Or we could say, you know what, we're going to look upstream and try to understand what are the root causes of many of these problems, and we can try to work there. And that is one of my hopes, is that if we can work far more upstream, if we can recognize that emotional well-being and nutrition and physical activity and sleep are some of the core pillars of prevention that can affect so many health outcomes we care about, then I believe we can make a very big impact with an investment that may not be nearly as expensive as we think it would be.
And let's hear from our callers. Raphael in San Francisco, hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. What's on your mind?
Great. Thank you so much. Well, thanks so much for this talk. I'm a mental health professional. I'm an intern, a psychotherapist intern, and I certainly am, in the front lines when it comes to, issues around depression and loneliness and anxiety and even, substance use. Though my hands sometimes feel tied because of the limits of my scope of practice in terms of treating addiction. But one thing I want to say, around loneliness and its effect on public health is that I'm so often seeing it show up in just the room. I'm in the front lines in terms of being that support person for a human being, to be that person that they can kind of disclose their, their deepest, most shameful secrets. And it's an amazing honor. And, of course, I so deeply want to support them to get good support out there with other people and how hard that is for them to find. So I just want to just appreciate kind of seeing on a meta level just how much effect it has on people. And the other thing I wanted to say and ask is that I'm curious about if you're familiar with the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experience study, and the effect of, kids experiencing violence, substance use, mental illness in the household, and how that affects their mortality later on, and how doctors, I think should be screening, because we're screening as psychotherapists, trying to get their attachment history, et cetera. If doctors are, asking, I'm wanting, I guess, doctors to ask more of those questions in terms of what their past is like, because it does actually, according to the study, and if you're familiar with it, shows a strong correlation between, difficult childhood experiences and the effects of mortality later on, including substance use disorder, diabetes and other, health issues that we see, in the public sphere.
Raphael, thank you.
So first of all, let me just want to thank you for the service that you're providing as a mental health practitioner. You're doing challenging but incredibly important work. And it's interesting for me to hear that you are seeing loneliness crop up in the examination room with patients. That's very similar to what I saw as well practicing medicine in Boston. I think the truth is that the loneliness is all around us. When a few weeks ago I wrote a Harvard Business Review article on loneliness in the workplace, and I could not have predicted just the powerful response that we have received from that in the form of stories from CEOs, from doctors and nurses, from factory workers, from students, from others who have said, I feel profoundly lonely and I just haven't been able to talk about that or admit that with anyone. I think loneliness is also rampant among young people, among our kids. You mentioned the ACEs study, which is a powerful study. For those who are not familiar with it, ACE stands for Adverse Childhood Experience. What that study showed is that the more adverse childhood experiences a child has, the greater their risk is for them to develop serious illness later in life. And this includes substance use disorders, mental illness, as well as physical disorders like heart disease and emphysema. And the correlation was really quite powerful, and it was stepwise, meaning that the more severe the trauma, the more cumulative the trauma, the greater the risk was down the line. Now, people used to look at this and say, well, this is probably because if you have a lot of stress as a kid, then you're more likely to develop bad behaviors later on. But more and more we're understanding when we look at the science and it actually imaging, brain imaging, we're recognizing that there are actually structural changes in the brains of children who have high exposure to trauma early on. They are actually being set up for illness at the earliest stages of life. This is yet another reason why I think it is so important for us to focus on creating a foundation for health for our kids from the earliest age. So we have to not only, again, reduce the stressors that can cause trauma for kids, but we also simultaneously need to work on equipping them with tools to deal with that stress when it arises.
Well, let me thank the caller and go next to Tom in Alameda. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I work in a major HMO institution in the Bay Area for the last 30 years. And as a support staff, I work closely with the ER and interview ER patients. And I notice in our hospital census over the years a trend that the patients that come in with suicidal ideation are either the very young or the very old, either under 30 or over 60 at a casual random glance. And I wanted to ask the doctor, since the comment he made, the profound observation that he said you can be in a room full of people or a world full of people yet feel very lonely. I find that very affecting on a personal level and intellectually, professionally. And I wanted to ask the doctor if there is a medical explanation for why the very young and the very old are most affected.
Tom.
Is it due to... yes.
Thank you.
So appreciate your question, Tom. The truth is that people all across the age spectrum are being impacted by loneliness and by depression and suicidal ideation. There's sometimes a detection bias, I would say, in terms of who might actually show up in a clinic. But the truth is that we're seeing this impact people all across the age spectrum. And, you know, people, you know, you brought up the point about feeling lonely, even though you're surrounded by lots of people. The truth is many people walk through life today feeling invisible, not seen for who they are and what they value, what they care about. And this is one of the points I think is really important. Whether you are running a business, whether you are in a school setting, creating an environment where people can truly see each other for who they are and know each other authentically is incredibly, incredibly powerful. When I was Surgeon General, we in fact created an exercise called the Inside Scoop to enhance our social connection in the office. And that was a simple 5-minute exercise that we would do at our weekly all-staff meetings. And that exercise involved giving people literally 5 minutes to share a selection of pictures that said something about their life. And that could be pictures of their family. It could be pictures of them engaged in activities that they loved, you know, earlier in life. But that simple act of sharing and hearing people's passion, that was so captivating for the people on our team. It was both therapeutic for the people who were speaking and the people who were listening. And what I found after that exercise is that there was a change in morale. People actually went from not always wanting to come to the all-staff meetings to it being their favorite meeting of the week. People were more likely to step outside their job description and help others because they felt more deeply connected to the mission. There was a saying we used to have in the world of nonprofits that people come for the mission, but they stay for the people. That is true in all walks of life. And being seen authentically and known authentically is a powerful part of creating true social connection.
We're talking with research scientist, Vice Admiral, former U.S. Surgeon General under President Obama, Vivek Murthy. And we're taking your calls and questions. And Mike writes, wasn't Dr. Murthy perhaps the least qualified Surgeon General in living memory with no public health experience and his nomination merely a political reward for heading up Doctors for Obama? You were 37 when you took the role, correct?
I was.
Did you hear this skepticism about your experience and qualifications?
Yeah, well, I did hear people who wondered, if I was too young for the role. And there were certainly, it is certainly the case that most of my predecessors were significantly older than I was. You know, I feel very blessed to have had the opportunity, though, to begin my public health work when I was very young. So when I was 17 years old, even before I trained in medicine, my sister and I entered the world of public health by building a nonprofit organization to address HIV in India and in the United States. And we worked on that for 8 years. And that actually led to a whole series of fascinating and eye-opening experiences where we also built a second organization to create public health partnerships and community health workers in rural parts of India and went on to do other things in research also to advance medicine and public health. And all those experiences together were very enriching for me. What they helped me learn at a young age was that public health and medicine are far too often separated and they should be integrated. They helped us understand that truly addressing public health issues is more than about passing a policy. It's about building partnerships and communities where people can inform how the challenges are actually addressed. And it helped us also understand that science has to play a big role in how we drive policy. As obvious as that sounds, people would say, of course, we should use science and drive public policy. That doesn't always happen. In fact, I would say often it does not happen. And there are many examples of that, in particular around vaccines, that we see. But I would say lastly, it gave me a powerful appreciation for the importance of communication. If you have great policies, but you can't communicate with people about them, they are limited utility. And that's why I found, interestingly enough, in my role as Surgeon General, all the things that I had worked on before seemed to come together in this role. My work building a technology company helped us when we were developing our opioid campaign and creating a platform for doctors. My work doing public education in India and the U.S. helped me think about how best to communicate with people, particularly the young. So I'm very grateful for the experience to have served. I hope that I was able to provide some service to the country and address some of our key health problems. But it is not. There's no doubt in my mind at all that I was the beneficiary of this role, because in this role, I learned so much from the American people. I left inspired by their decency, their kindness, and their commitment to creating a healthier and stronger America.
Well, Zarin has sort of a practical question here. How can we deal with an opioid abuser who's aggressive and not entirely open to medical intervention?
So Zarin's question is very important, because there is a significant proportion of people struggling with addiction who don't want to get treatment and either don't think it's necessary or don't think they're ready for it. There's no simple answer to this, but what I can tell you, having spoken to many individuals struggling with addiction and families who have surrounded them, is that we can't lose faith in people. We never know when they're going to open their minds to treatment. And what's so important for them is knowing that there's somebody out there who believes in them, who hasn't lost faith in them. Behind the anger that people with addiction sometimes have is a fear that they are destroying their lives and that they have lost the faith and love of those around them. But everyone I talk to who has walked through that dark tunnel of addiction and come out on the other side has said that it was the love and compassion and belief of somebody around them, a mom, a dad, a brother, a friend, that ultimately helped them make it through.
And we go to more callers. Rosalita in Berkeley. Hi, Rosalita.
It's Rosalina Goodman.
Oh, Rosalina. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for taking my call. And I wanted to suggest that Dr. Murphy has a regular radio show to bring the topics that he had been discussing today and many other public health issues. In response to what he brought up, and due to being a disabled survivor of fraudulently denied heart attacks and being one of the millions of victims of underpublicized crisis around women-specific heart disease, and as well as internationally recognized music educator and the expressive arts counselor, I have a two-part question. Number one, is the impact of the currently proposed cuts to the healthcare funding on already very high mortality rate in women due to the current medical crisis around the underpublicized epidemic of women-specific heart disease being addressed and discussed? And also, what, in your opinion, should be done in order to enforce the hospital compliance with the starting to emerge gender-specific research on women's hearts?
Rosalina, thank you. I just want to, we only have 2 minutes left, so I want to make sure that Dr. Murthy has a chance to respond.
Well, thank you for that question, Rosalina, and thanks for the idea about having a radio show. I'll take that under consideration. but I appreciate your more important question about women's heart disease and more broadly about illnesses and how they affect specific genders and ethnicities. You know, I do think that in the last several decades, we have put more effort and funds into understanding that how women are in fact different from men in terms of health, and how different ethnicities and races also respond differently to medicines, for example. And I think that has to be a continued part of where we invest time and research. I also think that it has to be part of what we measure in terms of success. And this is where healthcare systems come in. But I think at the heart of your question, I think, is a more fundamental question to me, which is at the heart of our country and at the heart of the values that drew my parents to this country is a notion that every life matters. And if every life truly has value, if every life matters, then we should be seeking to create a healthcare system that does serve everyone, whether they're a man or a woman, whether they're black or white or brown or whatever it might be. And that's the country that that I want for my kids. You know, when my wife was pregnant, we have a 1-year-old son. When she was pregnant, we sat down on the bed after figuring out that we were going to have a child and being so thrilled about it. But then a wave of fear passed through us. We asked ourselves, what kind of world are we bringing our child into? And we knew that there were a lot of challenges that we faced in the world right now. But what we do believe in our hearts is that our families and so many other families, whether it was a few years ago, a few generations ago, came to this country because they wanted to be in a place where every life did matter, where we were all treated equally, where we were respected for who we are and the ideas that we have. And we want to create that world for our son and for all kids as well. So to me, this has to be reflected in our policies, in our research. It has to be reflected in how we, more importantly, approach each other on a day-to-day basis. If we can do so in a way that's informed by compassion and by kindness, my hope is that we will create a world that's ultimately worthy of our children and ourselves.
Dr. Vivek Murthy, he's former U.S. Surgeon General under President Obama with expertise in gun violence, the opioid crisis, mental health, and the role of stigma in addiction, and has been focused more recently on the nation's emotional well-being and the effects of loneliness. Thank you so much for joining us on Forum this morning.
Thank you, Mina. Such a pleasure to be with you.
And thanks to our listeners for their calls and stories. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.